This is NFA Talk, the show that talks about guns and gun rights.
Keeping you up to date with what's currently going on, from the newest guns, promotions, and events,
plus how we're lobbying for your rights.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to this edition of NFA Talk. I'm Sheldon Clare, and today we're joined with Charles Zatch and Jordan Vandenhoff, with special guest Wes Winkle, president of the CSAAA, and Allison DeGroote, executive director of the CSAAA. Welcome. We're really glad to have you here. We have lots to talk about. Cash being spent of tax dollars to steal our property, changes in legislation, all kinds of things. Who wants to? Charlie, you want to give us an overview of what happened with the legislation recently? Tell us about your lobbying. What do you want to talk about?
Well, I don't have anything specific about the costing. I mean, this was strictly a CSAAA lane. I mean, they provided all the numbers to the government. You know, they created that rough underestimate, as far as I can tell. We're just talking about this before the show. You know, I'm having a great sense of deja vu again. You know, people who have lived through the liberal debacle of way back when they said that their long gun registry was going to cost $2 million and turned out to be $2 billion. So we're probably looking at the same kind of, situation here. We shall see. The liberals are terrified that, you know, these numbers are going to scare their voters. And so they should be, you know, especially since this measure, like many of their measures, have nothing to do with gun control, will be ineffective in deterring crime, and will be just a grand waste of money.
Absolutely. I mean, some of the numbers we've been hearing range from $7 billion to as high as even $18 billion or more when you factor in compound interest and infrastructure set up in order to handle this great theft. Allison, can you tell us a little bit about CSAAA's role in all of this and what you guys have been doing, or Wes, whichever
you guys want to?
Go ahead, Allison.
I'll start and then I'll let Wes jump in. Sure. But Wes did the bulk of the work. So as you know, Bill Blair's original estimate to taxpayers was this would cost $250 million for the 150,000 firearms that the government was aware of were on the ban list. Of course, the government was only aware of the restricted firearms. So any firearm that was prohibited and was previously restricted, that's the only number they had to work with. So that's the number they provided the PBO and as well as the Canadian taxpayer and Canadian public. So when the Parliamentary Budget Office came to us and they asked us for our numbers, because we literally are the only ones who could possibly even estimate how many of the non-restricted firearms were in the country. So Wes spent 2 weeks literally going through each of the 1,800 firearms on the FRT that have been prohibited by the OIC. Oh, and by the way, I love the fact that Bill Blair continues to say 1,500 when we're really closer to 1,900, according to the FRT right now. So Wes was diligent, and he called only the known authorized distributors for each of the 1,800 plus firearms on the FRT. And got their lifetime import numbers. So this would not include any firearms that were imported by individuals or any small shipments of firearms that were directly imported by individual retailers. This is just the numbers from the known distributors of those of the firearms listed on the FRT. We got about an 80% response rate. We made an educated guess on some, always to the conservative side. So the numbers that we provided the PBO were conservative, very, very conservative of the inventory that we estimate is in Canada right now. And we got a number closer to 518,000. And again, that's only including the firearms that have so far been identified on the FRT. We also have a legal opinion. As business owners, we had to interpret the language in the OIC to see what could potentially be threatened in the future. Because as you know, until we import a firearm, we don't know if the RCMP is going to designate it to be covered by the OIC. So we have a legal opinion that adds another 800,000 firearms to the list, a larger quantity. And we believe these are firearms that are covered by the OIC and just haven't been identified in the FRT yet. The PBO didn't use those numbers. They used our conservative numbers of the 1,800 that are on the FRT so far.
Okay, well, that's pretty scary. Wes, do you want to tell us about your efforts in this regard? Sounds like you put a fair bit of night oil in.
Well, yeah, it was one of those things where the PBO office approached us and, of course, did not give us a large time frame. To do a proper listing like this would take, honestly, years. So it was a matter of using the ability of what currently is being imported and going to those particular importers and talking about their numbers. But like everything, when you're doing something like that on a time crunch, you have to do some educated estimates based on, a lot of the current importers have not been the importers historically of the same product. You know, for example, right now we have Korth Group and Big Rock Sports is importing Ruger firearms. However, there's been lots of other historical distributors that have imported these firearms. So you have to kind of multiply out the number of firearms imported over the last 20 years and multiply that out historically for how long the firearm's been in circulation. So it does allow for discrepancy in the numbers, but the numbers are a very good educated guess. And it was a lot of – it's a lot of makes and models to put together and a lot of ones that, have a great deal of variance in value. For those that know, I spend a lot of my life doing the valuation of trades for a retail store. So you start to get a pretty good handle on what value the firearms have. However, in a lot of the cases, especially in the unique category of the 10,000 jewels, a lot of those higher end guns all depend on features and conditions. And, you know, you can give an estimate, but when you're talking about guns that are worth $50,000 and $100,000, they're very subjective as to the value of them. And you have no idea, even though that make and model was imported, how many features that particular person could have added on. So, yes, although we are very confident the numbers are conservative, I do believe those numbers are much higher than what are on the PBO report. It's just hard to justify them that way.
Absolutely. I had a call from Peter Hoff from Austria offering to make me a fine drilling rifle, and the price for that was $80,000 to $120,000, that range, depending on the kinds of features that I would have wanted on it. And I didn't end up getting anything because that's just way out of my price range. But when you start realizing there are rifles like that in Canada, and not just a few of them, this cost estimate the government has put out seems ridiculous. I guess you're completely in agreement that this is far too low, and we are looking at something that's a multi-billion-dollar boondock.
Absolutely. The number is not even far too low. It's laughable. That's the only way to describe it. The number of firearms involved and the value attached to them is laughable. And it's important that I think that they're trying to keep those numbers down, because down the road, whenever they want to start bragging about compliance and about how much effectiveness their program has, if they can keep that number as low as possible at the start, it lowers the expectations of how many firearms will be involved in the program. So I think it's very important now to get ahead of the game and to advise the country of how many firearms are actually affected, because as we all know, we don't expect compliance rates to be very high.
Oh, they won't be very high. I mean, I hear people who are taking precautions from them all the time, and they're angry. They're unsure why they're being targeted. This is like I don't know what it's like. It reminds me of the Kim Campbell era, where she took a run at us, and I think most of us here remember that quite well. Yeah. And when she was working on her summer job, talking about all the guns she was going to ban. I had a lovely debate with her up in Prince George here, and it just did not go well. And I told her, I said, you know what? You're done.
Yeah, I think it's really important. We had to be able, when we were giving the Parliamentary Budget Office the number, we had to prove the numbers. So I think that's why we stayed within bounds on a lot of the categories. And even then, we are still, what, like five times the estimate that the government has. And I think it's really important, and what the mainstream media missed in the story, and we appreciated the coverage that the PBO report got from the mainstream media, but what was not highlighted to Canadian taxpayers, and I think this is where the Canadian Federation of Taxpayers is getting on board on this conversation, is that doesn't even include the development, the administration, the execution of the program, which the PBO admitted they could not get any information from the government, nor could we. So we couldn't provide a comparative analysis, like how much it would cost. You know, we were able to give some industry numbers on, you know, deactivation cost between $80 and $250, but none of that the PBO could use because they haven't been provided by the government, and the government is not providing Canadian taxpayers the full cost of the program. I think all of you remember it took 2 years of diligent ATIP requests to get the full cost of the registry because it was buried in over 250 budget lines across multiple departments. And this is a situation I think Canadians will find themselves in again with this program, is they will, you know, the government will say it's going to cost whatever, $250 million. And that's just the tip of the iceberg, because they're not including any of the execution costs. So when we're having a conversation with taxpayers, which is the main messaging we as an industry have to get out right now, is we have to ask them, is this what you're willing to spend? I think the Fraser Institute estimated the cost would be roughly $5 billion. So I think it's a question we want to ask, not just our customers. I mean, we're all on the same side, but it's a question we want to ask our neighbors and fellow Canadians. Is $5 billion, is this how you want this $5 billion of your taxpayer dollars spent?
Especially with the huge debt that's been built up over the last 2 years. I think the thing that we got from talking to accountants about this is they said that the one thing that will really crank this up is compound interest, because there will be interest on all of these expenses, the cost of doing things. It will crank up the expense and needed budget for this program an astronomical amount. And this is where they were saying this could go, you know, 100, 200 times what they're actually saying. If you start looking at interest, and if you start looking at all of the costs that you quite rightly pointed out, this is going to be a huge, huge expense, which this country really can't afford. And quite frankly, none of this is necessary.
You know, that's the real question, is this how taxpayers want to solve crime? And is this actually going to make Canadians safer in the end? Because we all want our taxpayer dollars making us safer. And you know, the efficacy of this is just irrational.
You know, the interesting thing about this is that the reaction, both from, you know, public safety and, of course, mainstream media, you know, they basically dug their heels in, you know, especially the Antis out there as well, said, you know, basically telling you and, you know, the PBO that, you know, these are inflated numbers and, you know, they're exaggerated, et cetera, you know, and they're standing by their lowballing estimates, right? To me, this is basically a question of who do you trust? You know, the CSAAA has got a legacy of, you know, putting out, you know, evidence-based information, you know, that the government itself is using. You just said it. I mean, the PBO came to you for your expertise. Public safety has basically poo-pooed that and said that we don't believe it. So, you know, this is, you know, this political game of, you know, believe me over them is wearing really thin. I'm just hoping that, you know, their voter base out there, you know, are starting to understand exactly what's going on here.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Wes, go ahead.
No, the one thing I think that's important to mention on that, Charles, is that the PBO office did go to the minister's office first. They asked multiple times for the numbers. you know, the minister's office was not only unwilling, but they're unable to provide the numbers. They don't know. And they could have easily done some research on this before drafting this type of policy, but they don't, because it's all politically driven. There's no debate there. And that's what's so frustrating here, is that there's no ability for the minister's office to contradict the numbers, because they can't. They have no idea what they're talking about in this case.
Absolutely.
I mean, we're seeing this in multiple issues with this government. We're seeing it in the in some of the legal actions taking place, where even when ordered by a judge to provide information, the government is unable to, not just in our category, and in other categories too, in pandemic spending, in situations at Canadian labs, medical labs, and this is a government that has taken is taking their own speaker to court, and it's just, you know, we have lots of conversations with members of the bureaucracy who are full time employees, and it's incomprehensible sometimes to some of them too.
Yeah, Jordan, what are you hearing on the street?
What am I hearing on the street?
Yeah, what are you hearing at the range?
I can tell you what's coming through the chat lines. Nobody's giving their stuff up is what's going through the chat lines. I want to circle back to earlier. We talked about, you know, the implication to put these programs in place and the money they're going to spend. Now imagine if they actually spent that money, if they took that money and spent it on programs and gave it to police forces to actually go after the root cause, which is not law-abiding firearms owners. You know, if they had better control over our borders from these illegal guns being smuggled in, if they went after the gangs in the major cities and they put a dent to that, the gun violence would come down in Canada, and we wouldn't be sitting here, you know, worried about the government going after us and taking away our guns.
How about we back up even further than law enforcement? How about we back up all the way to poverty, disenfranchisement?
Absolutely.
I bet you there's a lot of grassroots organizations who would think $5 billion would be a gift from heaven. Like, Wes and I sat at the Guns and Gang Summit, and it was quite clear from the grassroots organizations, you know, these organizations who are really, really working deep at the community level, at the grassroots level with at-risk youth, they get funding for 2 years, then their funding gets canceled. They have amazing stories of efficacy and success at diverting young people. And they get, you know, $50,000 for 2 years, and then it disappears. No matter how good the program is, how much they can prove they are stopping crime before young people get involved in these gangs. How about $5 billion to those organizations? Well, then you wouldn't even need the law enforcement.
This would actually make a difference, right? I mean, this is the thing. I used to work with young offenders. I worked in a residential attendance program for young offenders many years ago, and we saw great success with limited investment. But those programs are getting all pushed away, because they do have some expenses associated with them. They're work intensive. And they build responsibility. The recidivist rates are very, very low for the, we call them students, that go through those programs. So they don't go back to crime for the most part. And I think you're absolutely right, Allison. There are so many things out there that taxpayer dollars would be better spent on than trying to keep a list of who has guns, what they are, where they are, and then deciding that some of them are bad guns and we're going to take them away until we're all basically left with nothing, which seems to be the game plan here. I mean, you see what's going on in New Zealand. Trudeau clearly has a thing for their prime minister and her way of doing things. Anything that looks dictatorial or authoritarian, he's right there. So you know, we're getting an awful lot of trouble over.
Let's not forget what our grassroots police forces are actually saying. I mean, we've lobbied the RCMP union, and they've come out with their own statement saying that, you know, this gun ban is not going to do anything, and they don't stand by it. I tried to follow that up with the police chiefs, and I tried to talk with the president many times, and I finally got a hold of one of his assistants, and they said they would not comment at this time. because this was a very internal contentious issue. Unlike what Bill Blair said, that, you know, all the police chiefs are on side with this. Well, I can tell you that they're not. You know, in August, the police chiefs are having their regular annual AGM, and they're going to be discussing these things, and we'll see what rolls out of that, right? I don't know how they're going to go against what their you know, on the ground, boots on the ground police are saying no. And if they say yes, how are they going to bridge that gap politically? I have no idea.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because our business owners work on a daily basis with law enforcement. And you know, it's amazing what we can get done without political involvement. So we've been working for the past three or four years now with RCMP and West program on straw purchasing awareness training. You know, we're able to get programs going that are effective, that are functioning, if you keep the politics out of it. So straw purchasing is a tiny, tiny part of the problem in Canada, but it's the only one that we can actually take action or make a contribution to. We can't fix poverty in Toronto. We can't fix, middle class or wealthy kid gangs in Vancouver. Yeah. Straw purchasing, which is a small part of the problem, is something we can work on. And we are actively working on that with law enforcement. We have a collaborative initiative with the RCMP NWEST that's shared with among the CFO offices. We've had NWEST at our trade show for 3 years now. We've arranged meetings with NWEST and the CFO offices who, believe it or not, had never met before, even though their agencies and their functions overlap. So, you know, we can get stuff done if we keep the politics out of it. But I think that takes, you know, people with knowledge on the subject. So I don't have knowledge on gangs in downtown Toronto, and nor do our business owners. So that's not a problem we can address. I really think Canadians and the government needs to go to that community and ask them what they need. I think the trouble with this legislation is that it was sold by the Liberal government as a crime bill, and it was never a crime bill. Yeah. This legislation is the result of dedicated lobbying by one organization to solve one crime in Canada. And unfortunately, that crime was committed by a licensed firearms owner. So the real misleading of the Canadian public is that this is crime legislation. It was never crime legislation. It was always to target licensed firearms owners, and it was always designed to solve one crime.
Well, we've always been the low-hanging fruit in this kind of a debate. And it's been the case since the 1960s. When we were busy aping the Americans' 1968 Gun Control Act and trying to turn that into C-51, ultimately, which created the classification system that we suffer through today. None of this stuff has ever been anything about public safety or making people feel safe. They never say actually be safe. They always say feel safe. It's always, always, always been about taking away our stuff, civil disarmament, and trying to change our culture. We used to have these shooting competitions across the country. Young people used to shoot in their high schools. Cadet programs were much more active in the shooting activities. And now it's all gone to pellet guns. They're trying to eliminate air rifles, airsoft, all kinds of things. And none of this has anything to do with anything but ideological woke left politics. And it's appalling.
You know, Sheldon, and that's a great point. I just want to backtrack on Alice because she really underscored something profound in what she said. You know, the government pontificates about all these different things about public safety. They want to do this, they want to do that, and everything else. You know, they'll put out these virtual signaling, you know, regulations and measures, but fail to execute. You know, the CSAAA, we've had this discussion, Alice, and I mean, you guys are really doing the work of the straw purchasing interference. You know, people are coming to you. You're relaying that information to the RCMP, and you know, you're part of the bureaucracy. It really shines on the incompetence of the whole idea that big government is going to save us here. You know what? We are we are all interested in public safety. We don't want firearms in the hands of criminals and, you know, miscreants out there who shouldn't have firearms in their hands. And we are perfectly capable of self-regulating ourselves. The CSSA is a shining beacon of that right now, right? So, you know,
CSAAA, you mean?
CSAAA, sorry. Yeah. You know, but, you know, this really, you know, if the government can't do it, you know, we can and we do. Right. So we just need that kind of direction to do that.
And that's part of the thing, like with the straw purchasing initiative and a lot of these youth intervention programs that we learn about, the amount of money that they ask for is such a small amount compared to what we're talking about in this PBO office report. You know, we're asking for one employee help with the straw purchasing program across the country, and we can't get that. We're talking about less than $100,000. And same with, we're talking about youth music and youth sports programs that are, like Allison said, asking for a couple $100,000 across Canada, and they get their funding canceled. But yet we're going to do this mind-numbing exercise of buying and destroying guns, all because they want a video of guns going in a melter to sell in a political ad. That's all they want.
That's absolutely right. And the thing that's funny is these programs that provide opportunities for young people actually do work. They make a difference. If you can take people away from the sources of crime and bad influence and all of that and give them opportunities, self-funded partnership, public-private partnership opportunities, that makes a difference. This stuff, God, I mean, they would get better results if they actually funded shooting programs for youth in this country rather than trying to get rid of guns.
We actually, in a recent meeting, Wes and I were begging for funding for an NWEST staff person because we need a retail coordinator. Because right now, the way the program works is retailers call me, I call my contact at NWEST who's championing this program internally there. And that's how straw purchasing gets reported in Canada. What we really need, we even had an incident where an individual thought the buyer, another individual buyer, thought there was something funny, wanted to report it. That person called a representative of one of the consumer groups who called me, and I called NWEST. And so we were lobbying the RCMP literally to fund a person who could be a single point of contact for retailers across the country who wanted to report suspicious purchasers. And it's so ridiculous. Even NWEST can't communicate directly with the CFO offices because they actually have to get a warrant to get information from another RCMP division, from the CFO office.
Well, the CFO offices have become their own little fortresses and fiefdoms unto themselves lately. The rules have increased, access has been cut back.
I have to say, Sheldon, that's not their fault. Literally, in Ontario, which is a perfect example, they haven't had a funding increase despite the continued additional duties that the CFO is responsible for and more to come with Bill C-71, mm-hmm. They haven't had a budget increase or a staff increase in 10 years.
Yep.
So all these programs are said to be awash financially, and we're seeing that in the regulations for Bill C-71, where the government is saying there's no additional cost to this, there's no additional cost. Well, if there's not going to be an additional cost, they're not even going to be effective because the CFOs can barely do what's on their list right now. We frequently in Ontario have backlogs of restricted transfers numbering in the 3,000 to 4,000. That's how far behind they are on their job today, let alone what they're going to be asked to do.
We, of course, have some ideas about reducing that workload considerably. Which would involve getting rid of the restricted and prohibited categories completely and also a full review of the Firearms Act. But that's probably beyond the scope of what we're going to see out of this government or the next one.
Well, yes and no. I mean, you know, the conservatives have already come out and also criticized the, you know, this funding, not so much in terms of the numbers, but, you know, in the contrast between what public safety has put out and, you know, what the CSAAA and the PBO put up, you know, this yawning gap, you know, of numbers between, you know, one claim versus another, right? So, you know, I'm just hoping, you know, the elections, you know, it's on, we're on the precipice of that. You know, people are saying maybe in August that the, you know, writ will be dropped. You know, I'm just hoping that people are listening to, you know, what's going on here so that, you know, they can arm themselves with the information to vote accordingly.
Yeah. And when it comes to those administrative costs, if you're, you know, when we're talking to the regular Canadian public about that, I mean, it took $2 billion just to create a list. That is the smallest part of the task they're asking us to go down the road now. Now they want to collect the guns. They want to catalog them. They want to evaluate them, which is not a small process, and then destroy them and transport them. Like the whole program is so massive and enormous. If they want to do it properly, if it took $2 billion to make a list, I can't even begin to estimate what it will cost to do that all inside a government bureaucracy.
One of our accountants said it would cost $25 billion, is what he said. $25 billion. That's $20 billion more than your very conservative estimates of $5 billion. I wonder about how they do their costing. Like, do they just pick a number and look at it and say, well, we've got to keep it below a billion, or they call it a billion-dollar boondoggle for political reasons? I'm sure that discussion was had. So it would be $750 million. You know, this is from a government that says the budget will balance itself. Really?
You know, that's a good point, Sheldon. You know, and we are in a different era. You know, I mean, when that resonated with the, you know, the general public out there and the voters, right? We did have, you know, good fiscal management of the country, more or less, right? From all the parties. That's gone out the window a long time ago. Okay, so, you know, we're getting bombarded with, you know, spending budgets of billions and billions here and billions. I don't think people even care anymore that, you know, we're spending all these billions. We're so far gone that, you know, I'm afraid that even a $5 billion or even a $25 billion, you know, price tag on gun confiscation, I'm not sure if that's going to resonate with anybody at this point in time. People are just so jaded.
It should resonate with people that have children, because at some point they're going to have to pay this back.
Exactly right.
Well, yeah, that should have happened 4 years ago.
Yeah.
Well, the way I like to explain it to people not in the gun community is, you're going to lose your shirt on your house because none of our kids can afford to buy one. And they won't. If this continues, we are going to lose all of our money because nobody can afford to buy our real estate.
Well, if people would take some lessons from history. And I think that I had somebody in the barber shop the other day say something like, well, if the government needs more money, they should just print more and then everything will be fine. And I was just like, oh my God, my head is exploding. I'm going, do you understand what happened in the Weimar Republic in the 1920s in Germany? What happened in Mexico? What happened in all of these countries around the world when they thought that printing money would solve their problems? Oh my God.
It's happening in Lebanon right now.
Yes. It's foolish. You know,
yeah. But, you know, and the part about this infrastructure, too, that I think a lot of Canadians might think in the back of their heads that, these guns will just go to a police station. The volume of guns we're talking about. I mean, I go to property vaults on a regular basis. I'm probably in at least two a week for some reason, because some guy does something that he shouldn't do and I have to go get his property. But there is no room in any of these property vaults now. There is no room for any of this program inside the current police structure at all. I mean, it has to be created. It is a ridiculous concept.
And think of the huge nature of Canada. Well, I mean, one of our defining characteristics is the massive geographical distances that we enjoy in this country. You have communities all over the place. There's no way they have the infrastructure. Hell, they couldn't store my gun collection in the local police station, let alone the accumulated numbers from the regional district around here. It's ridiculous. They're going to have to build buildings. They're going to have to hire significant staff. Gary Mauser was looking into the numbers for this, and he was just going, well, you know, take their number, times it by 20, and you're probably getting into the ballpark. It's insane. It makes no sense. And the problem is, if these guys win this election, this is going to be policy. And we cannot let this happen.
Yep. You know, it's interesting what you just said there, Sheldon, because they're already calling for that now. I've read a couple of op-eds where they're saying, oh, we need a real national police force so that they can go out and, you know, crash into people's houses and confiscate these guns. And I'm just shaking my head. I'm going,
that won't go well.
Well, it won't go well, but I'm just, you know, the mentality of that whole authoritarian, you know, idea, you know, is astounding to me, right? And it should be to all freedom-loving Canadians out there. But, you know, that could well be a reality. You know, like you said, if the Liberals get in, they'll splash the money at the resources, manpower, right, to dedicate it. You know, like if they bring in their bylaw situation in the cities, yeah, you know, I they'll be coming door to door. I don't know how they're going to do that, but, you know, they'll bump up their manpower to do that.
And, that came up in our conversations with the PBO, because they're using New Zealand as the only model that they can to sort of predict, you know, what percentage of firearms would be at 100% value, what percent. And you see this in their report. And when we spoke to them, they admitted that New Zealand is not the best comparison. New Zealand is an island. And even as an island, they are three times over budget and at only 30% compliance. So, and that's a tiny, like, wallable country. It's an island. You can be at every border point, a tiny country, and they're still only at 30%, and they've already spent three times what they budgeted for the program.
Well, it looks at the low rates of compliance in Quebec with the Quebec Provincial Registry program. I mean, that's abysmal. Their whole thing there is just catch them as they can. And
I'm pretty sure businesses are the only ones who have actually registered their firearms in Quebec.
I'm pretty sure that's the case, Allison. I just wanted to say I really appreciate the work that the CSAAA has been doing on this file and other things as well. I mean, we didn't talk about CANPAR and the shipping of firearms. That's a huge problem right now that probably a lot of businesses and firearms owners, customers are interested in. One of the things I always took pleasure in when I spoke at the Second Amendment Foundation's conferences in the United States is I would tell them, well, in Canada, we can buy firearms mail order. And they would all look at me in horror. What? We haven't been able to do that since 1968. And I say, well, that's freedom, baby. And it's crazy what's going on in shipping right now. What sort of progress have we seen in this? Allison West, do you have any information for us about that?
Yeah, I mean, we've had the shipping. To be honest, Sheldon, the industry's under attack. It's in the shipping side. It's in the banking side. It's in the insurance industry. We are having trouble all the time getting service providers to provide service to our industry, and the shipping one is just the newest one. And it's honestly a bit of a disaster for the industry. What we have is, CANPAR made a very rapid knee jerk reaction to some negative press, and, you know, inside of a pandemic, it was a difficult process. The delivery process has been difficult. The fact that they did it on a moment's notice without any warning really caught the industry with its pants down, so to speak. We had most of our stores were shipping with CANPAR exclusively, and they had no other option to provide their consumers. And this made us scramble as an industry association to try to provide help to our members. And also to provide a service to the customers.
And we were happy to support you in the process, because we actually thought this was salvageable. And, you know, we made sure that we were trying to get all the facts, get all the information before we went out there and just started firing away willy-nilly. You know, the fire ready aim process doesn't seem to work really well. You know, we try to follow a little bit of a different process, but I really think that you were doing the right things. And you're right, we're under attack. Firearms ownership is under attack. The industry is under attack. I mean, we're going to be at the United Nations the end of the month to defend firearms owners and users and industry in a global sense. And I note that our old friends from the Coalition for Gun Control have gotten funding again, that the Liberals are back in power. They'll be there. And we're also going to be going to Geneva at the end of August to try to fight this stuff in a global sense too. So it's a worldwide problem, and our opponents are talking to each other and sharing information. And fortunately, we've been able to build some bridges internationally and share information as well. And it's appalling.
Yeah, the logistics, of course, from the consumer side, they see the CANPAR but Campire was part of a much larger company, and we also lost some large freight companies that bring inventory to our stores across the border and vis-a-vis. So this is, it was a very large complex problem that is nowhere near being solved. We were able to work with UPS to get a lot of stores on board shipping with UPS and to get some services moving and some product moving to consumers. But it's been a big challenge because, like we said on the gun grab file, we now have the same situation with the vastness of Canada. You know, we have a lot of very remote rural areas where it honestly is not profitable to deliver product to. You know, it just is not. You know, if you live up in Nunavut or northern BC or, you know, the very rural parts of Newfoundland, you know, there's only one shipment a month going to Billy Bob's farm. And that's the reality of it. So it's hard to get service providers to want to provide that service to that area. Well, so we've been working very hard with Canada Post to try to bring them on board.
So what's happening with the price of ammunition now, guys? I mean, oh, my God, I went to pick up a couple of thousand, a couple of months ago when I picked up a few thousand of other rounds, it was this price. All of a sudden, I'm looking at a price that's almost 50% higher than what it was, and I just went, "What? I've got to go back and clean up my reloading room because I looked at this and I thought that's too much." So what's going on there?
Well, and again, the a lot of consumers chalked it up to supply and demand, but that's not exactly true. What's happened here on the ammunition side is exactly what's happening in some of the other building of any product, whether it be houses or anything else. The raw material cost has gone through the roof. The raw material transportation cost has gone through the roof. Then once you're trying to assemble the product, we have all these social distancing rules inside these factories. So they're running at 30% capacity. So they're obviously not able to produce ammunition as efficiently as they used to be able to. And then the biggest component of the new pricing is the freight once it leaves that factory. You know, we just received a shipment from overseas, a shipment that we got 12 months ago at the same time, at the same size, which cost $2,300 in freight from overseas, and now costs $5,600 for the same shipment. Yeah. And that has to be passed on. And again, that's inside a lot of the regulatory framework. It's like I said at the start of this conversation, we're being attacked from all different angles. It doesn't matter if you're paying more for insurance or freight or manufacturing, all those costs add up into that price of that box of shells. And I can tell you that it's not going to slow down anytime soon. And when you said the other part, which is to try to reload to save some money, the components is even more under attack. Because the ammunition companies make more money loading the components, so they don't want to bottle it up and sell it to us.
Well, I found the price of powder, for example, has really jumped up. I mean, when I buy powder, I tend to buy a fair bit of it. And this is one of the reasons that the NFA was so invested in the development of changes to the Explosives Act, so we could increase the amount of things you can store in your dwelling house and so on. We had a great deal of success with that. But I'm looking at the cost of this, and this is a game they're playing at the UN, is trying to cost this whole enterprise so that the people who are involved in this just can't afford to do it anymore. And they're looking for ways to increase costs with taxation or with regulatory structures that make it impossible for the average person to get into this and to enjoy these sports and activities.
Yep, and it's all the way through the process. You know, we're paying more money to import. We're paying more money. You know, a lot of the stores' insurance have gone up by 30 or 40% the last couple of years because there's a lot less providers being able to offer it. And again, if you're trying to run a profitable business, that has to be passed along in your pricing structure.
Oh, you have to be able to make your 30% or you're not going to be able to keep the doors open. That's just the way it is. And in some cases, there's some other margins that you have to adjust for. I remember when I worked retail and worked in a store that sold firearms, the markup on the guns actually wasn't very much. It was the markup on the clothing and everything else that had to pay for that. The firearms just brought them in the door. You know, that's kind of it was a funny thing for that model. But now it's getting scary. And I mean, I really feel for anyone who's trying to get into the shooting sports and these activities, and there's all these barriers are there. And the price and cost and everything, and they're all wondering, well, is this really worth it? Maybe I should just and they can't even race cars or anything like that, because that's all going to be out too. It's really, really getting bad.
Well, the good news is what our retailers are telling us is there is a huge, huge pent-up demand for new PALs. So all of the programs, all of the courses have been, and it was because of the pandemic. It's really been very interesting. Wes, you can maybe touch on this a little bit, but the number of potential new customers coming into stores over the course of the pandemic looking to get their firearms license, but couldn't register for a course because all of the courses have been paused. So we could see a surge in participants once things open back up.
Yeah,
I think so.
A large increase in the sales of youth model firearms and youth directed hunting gear. And I think part of that is that a lot of your mainstream activities, whether it be your music and your guitar lessons or your sports like hockey and baseball, where they were shut down because of the pandemic. So that left parents, the only way to occupy their youth's time was to put them in front of a screen, which even the hardest core gamer gets tired of at some point. So you've seen parents starting to teach their kids to take them outside. And all of a sudden we started to see them going fishing and hunting again. And bringing the youth back into the sport. And we saw a large uptick in youth model firearms and youth model clothes. And it was fantastic to see the kids coming back in. And we're hoping that this pandemic time, they got enough time to try it and hopefully enjoy it, that we will see a large growth in this certain demographic of this youth that spent some time outdoors over the last year. It was a bit of a bonus to the industry for sure.
Well, I appreciate your positive spin on all this horrible stuff there, Wes and Allison. That's a really great way to look at it. I hope that's the case. I mean, I'm a core examiner for the Hunter Training Program in British Columbia, and I know that there have been pressure for courses, but there have been fewer and fewer people who've been stepping forward to take them, or they found it more and more difficult or onerous. But there's certainly lots of space out there. And there are lots of opportunities. I mean, I'm lucky I managed to get some draws this year, which have been a bit of an evasive or elusive is the right word thing for the past little while. But I'm looking forward to a good positive hunting season. What else do we need to discuss? Is there anything that you want to talk about that we haven't raised? I think we've covered a pretty good bit of ground there.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that I want to bring forward with your membership is that, as you guys have mentioned, and we all are aware that this fall is going to be a massive election for us as gun owners in a gun industry. And, you know, the only way that those tides turn is people have to be vocal at all of their social functions. Now that the world's opening back up again, when you're at that dinner party, when you're at that, you have to not be scared to talk and to voice the concerns and to start to turn the political tide. Everyone is so uncomfortable to discuss politics, and you know, because it's always a contentious issue. But if we don't talk about it in those venues, we won't turn the tide, and we have to turn it. If we lose this one coming up, not just on the gun file, heaven help Canada. Like I'm very concerned for my kids going forward.
I couldn't have said it better. I think that's exactly right. We need to get involved in politics. We need to speak up, all of us, not just the people in this little forum here today who have been very active and are really strong promoters of a good, strong Canada, which means the people who have some freedom. And we really got to step up. Charlie, you've been working the lobbying circuit pretty heavy. That's yes. Going well.
I have. And of course, you know, the barbecue season has started now and, you know, the lobbying has kind of slowed down a bit. But now we'll be ambushing these people at their picnics. So, you know, that's going to be the new strategy going forward. But just going back to Wes's point about getting involved, you know, like, I mean, you know, the firearms community is famous for yelling at stop signs and the television and, yeah, not talking about it, you know, in different venues when they should. Right. I also want to encourage everybody. We are at a tipping point. I've said this before. The Liberals get back in. You will lose your handguns. You'll lose more firearms. And we may be, you know, in a place where, you know, we will see wholesale civil disarmament in the next little while. So, and we don't want that to happen, right? So the only way you can do that is you need to get involved physically, right? Some way or another. Join your local CPC EDA. Volunteer on your candidate's campaign. Everybody's ramping up now. You know, I'm heading the, you know, the sign team of my Oakville North Burlington candidate here, Hannon Riscala. And, you know, I'm doing everything I can to help my local candidates as well, too, in Burlington and Flamborough and Milton and, you know, Oakville, everything else. I'm doing what I can. Of course, you know, I'm only one guy. I can only cover, you know, several thousands of miles. No, just kidding.
Well, I think we've seen people from the community also start to step up and get involved in politics. I mean, a lot of the issue that we're up against is I'm not sure that we're getting the right people in politics in the first place. You know, right, Charles, you know, in Burlington, Emily Brown, who is just a fantastic, brilliant woman, awesome spokesperson for the industry. She just put her money where her mouth is, and she ran for the candidacy for the Burlington, her Burlington riding. You know, seeing people like that step up and get involved in politics is super encouraging. So, not just volunteering, but you know, not all of the candidacies have closed. Not all of the ridings have picked candidates yet. So there's still lots of opportunity for good people to step up. And I also think that it's really important for firearms owners and members of the business community to get together and speak knowledgeably about the economic impacts of the industry and in their community, not just the businesses, but the ranges, the activities, the hunting licenses. And we've offered our members, we just set out in our e-newsletter today, offered our members assistance. So we're encouraging that businesses in the same area, and this is tough because they're competitors, but in this case, it's really important for businesses to get together and to meet with the candidates. And here's the really interesting twist on it, which we did here in Peterborough. Peterborough happens to be an epicenter for the firearms industry. It's this tiny community, and yet we have over 350 jobs here in Peterborough tied to the industry, 250,000 square foot of manufacturing and warehouse space. We have three big distributors. We have one of Canada's last manufacturers. We have four retailers in the area. And we went through the process of introducing ourselves to all of the candidates in Peterborough, with, regardless of what party. We invited all of them. Not all of them showed up. But just to let them know that when you're talking about the firearms file here in the Peterborough region, you are talking about over 300 jobs. So be careful what you're saying in Ottawa, and be careful what you're letting your party get away with. You know, we have a representative here, Miriam Monsef, who doesn't say a word about the 300 jobs that are at risk in her riding. And that's unforgivable to me. So we encourage, and we did this last election too, where we took the economic impact survey and went out at the grassroots level and invited all candidates to a business to show them what the industry was bringing to their community and what the consumers were bringing to their community. Because this is, we contribute to the GDP of our local communities. We contribute to the GDP of this country. So it is not a write-off to see 45,000 jobs disappear across Canada.
Absolutely not. I mean, the WFSA, which we're heavily involved in, has done a lot of studies on the economic effects of hunting, the shooting sports, and anything to do with firearms, including the self-defense industry. And it's massive across the world, and it's especially massive in North America, including Canada. And I think that messing with that and the amount of people that are indirectly and directly affected by this has got to come at a political cost for this government.
Well, I hope it encourages all candidates to think twice and to take a look around their riding and see, because, you know, you will have people who don't even recognize our industry. They probably stop at one of our retailers on the way to the cottage and don't know that that retailer is being affected by this legislation. we saw many, many, many rural Liberal MPs in the last election cycle felt like they got thrown under the bus by the Liberals' firearms policy. So even though the PMO's office might be a unified voice, I hardly think that I truly believe that there are Liberal MPs and NDP MPs in rural ridings who don't agree with this policy. And I think those are conversations we should be having. And I think even as individuals and as firearms owners, let's have conversations with Canadian taxpayers about this too. It doesn't matter who you vote for. This is not good public policy, period. It's not effective. It's expensive. And it's going to affect businesses. I mean, probably our business owners coach your kid's hockey team, and you don't even know that that person is in the sporting arms retail business. So I do think we have to expand our conversation beyond the firearms community and beyond the owners community, and really speak to Canadians about what it means to have sound public policy around firearms.
Well, Allison, Wes, that's probably a great place to end this. Thank you very much for all you've been doing on behalf of firearms owners. And I think we'll conclude it there. All the best.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of NFA Talk.
Like and follow the NFA on social media and sign up to become a member.